Well, thank you very much. And happy Saturday night, happy early Sunday morning, and generally happy Father's Day to all that applies to. We're talking tonight with Dr. John Casty, X-Events, the collapse of everything. I kept saying the end of everything. That's not it. It's X-Events, the collapse of everything. And when we come back, let's talk about a nuclear Iran. Ahmed, are you building a nuclear bomb over there? If you were to answer truthfully, he would say, of course. But, you know, there are other things. There's Saudi Arabia. Talk about a difference between the haves and the have-nots. But that nuclear Iran thing, everybody seems to be, I don't know, I get the feeling some people are really hoping that they can prove they're making a bomb so they can make their move and have their war, but that's just me. No, it's not just me. It's a lot of people. So we'll get into that with Dr. John Casty in just a moment. Let's just take a little short break and get back into it. We'll also take some of your calls as well. Unpredictable music, unpredictable topics, unpredictable callers. Just like these unpredictable events on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John Casty, this book, X Events, The Collapse of Everything, these are not predictions. They're just possible scenarios, yes?
That's correct. In fact, I have to say that I don't think that it's possible to predict an X event or actually human social events in general in the same way that we use the term to predict something in physics or astronomy or engineering. I think that that there's no method living yet or yet to be born that can consistently and reliably predict social events.
Isn't that strange? I mean, people are experimenting with pre-crime and thought reading and all of that. It's like, I wonder why these techniques can't be, I mean, outside of a natural disaster. I'm talking about stuff like, well, let's take this nuclear thing, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody in the Northern Hemisphere is interested in any kind of a nuclear exchange. Certainly the Europeans aren't. The Russians, they're forceful and they'll saber rattle, but they don't want any of that. China's just getting rolling. They're just actually being able to enjoy the prosperity that they did not have 50 years ago, that's for sure. But that Middle East remains a little wacky.
Well, you know, there's a difference between the interests of a nation state, and you've mentioned China, U.S., say France or whatever, other nuclear powers, and the interests of a terrorist group or even a kind of mad individual. The problem, of course, is that, especially with the downfall of the former Soviet Union, a lot of nuclear weapons that used to be more or less safely guarded in arsenals somehow just disappeared. And it's a little bit unclear where they've gone. Or you might have a nation state like North Korea, kind of rogue state, that might see it in its best interest to at least come up to the edge of the nuclear attack just to exert pressure. And so I think that the prospects for some kind of nuclear weapon going off, either deliberately or even by accident, is a lot higher now than it was back in, let's say, the 1960s when I was working on these kind of questions at the Rand Corporation.
Do you think Iran's developing a bomb? I personally do.
This is an interesting point. I think that you're probably right, but on the other hand, if I think back to some years ago, about Iraq and all of the rhetoric that was floating around about weapons of mass destruction and Iraq and so on. And in fact, there was no such thing. It was just that, rhetoric. So I don't know. And that's the problem. Nobody really knows except the Iranians. And they're not saying. It's to their interest not to say.
Do you get the feeling they're being pushed toward something, some sort of an event? I mean, do you when you make your calculations as to what constitutes a real threat, There's the threat, there's the potential threat, and then there's the goading them into threatening us part.
Well, I think that in this particular Iranian situation, I think the biggest, let's say, credible threat is a preemptive strike by the Israelis, or some combination of the Israelis plus the U.S., or at least with the complicity of the U.S. in dealing with perceptions of an Iranian nuclear weapon. But I don't have any privileged information in this respect. I mean, I know the same thing you do. Basically, what I read in the newspaper and hear from various parts of the media and a few people that, you know, you talk to from time to time. But I think that this is if you think back to the Iraqi war, a major, maybe even the major deciding factor of attacking Iraq was the belief that they had a nuclear weapon. It was, let's call it a preemptive strike, if you like. And I'd hate to see that repeated. It was very expensive.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. Now, where on the let's jump to the other end of the spectrum. What seems to be the one that's the biggest dot on the radar screen as far as where we're going to get this in one form or another? It may be a derivative. It may not be as severe as we think, but this is definitely going to occur.
In terms of, are you referring to a nuclear attack or just
a general X event? Yeah, general X event.
Well, I think that the one in my list of 11 that I talk about in the book X Events, the one that I regard as sort of the most likely to occur is the problem of economic, the financial deflation. Now, that's not a kind of X event that a lot of people sit around worrying about because they say, oh, yeah, this unfolds over years. And a little bit like global warming, in a sense. There aren't so many people that really, in their everyday lives, you wake up in the morning and say, boy, I'm really worried about global warming. But you know, it's almost inevitable. And I think that a global unwinding of the vast mountain of debt that's been accumulated, not just in the U.S. or in Europe, but worldwide, there's not enough money in the world to clear out that debt. And the only realistic way for it to be unwound is some kind of deflation, not inflation. So I think that on my list of 11 extreme events in part two of X Events, I think that's the one that I would regard as the most likely, but it's not going to happen overnight.
You know, the interesting thing here is as I look at this list of possibilities, they could very easily chain together.
Yeah, they're not independent.
No, not at all. In fact, you know, let's jump around to Anthony Bourdain's favorite topic. That would be food. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the loss of the bees.
Yeah.
And then this chapter is entitled, When Do We Eat? The Breakdown of the Global Food Supply System. That looks like a distinct possibility because the latest research that I've seen on the global warming thing, and again, it is warming. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But it is not warming the same way all over. Even in the United States, the Southwest is most definitely warming, and other parts haven't warmed at all in several decades.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I see that here in Vienna. I first came here in 1973. It was, 39 years ago now. And in those days, you could reliably count on snow in the city every winter for a couple weeks or more. You could reliably count on a few days during the course of the summer where it would be kind of hot and humid, sort of Washington, D.C. style, but nothing too serious. Now, what do we see? We see snow in the city very rarely. Maybe once every few years you get a few days where the snow actually stays. And in the summertime, instead of a few days of hot, humid weather, you get weeks of it. In fact, it's starting right now, just more or less as I speak. I look out my window. Of course, it's mid-morning now in Vienna. And it's going to be in the mid-80s today, and it's going to be humid. And so I saw a study in one of the local newspapers some time back of all the capital cities of the European Union and how the average temperature has changed over the last 20 years. So this is the highs and lows averaged over the entire year. And what has actually happened is that it's all gone up. Everywhere it's gone up. Vienna is somewhere in the middle, and the average temperature change is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, which doesn't sound like much. This is the deceptive part. You know, it doesn't sound like much, except when you actually look out your window and are experiencing it every day, it really turns into a lot. But Vienna wasn't the worst. Copenhagen was the worst in terms of average temperature change. It was more than twice that. So it's not a mirage. It's not a fiction of somebody's imagination that this warming is taking place, but it's kind of like a slow train wreck, and so you can say yes, it's taking place, but it's not here yet, and or at least the impact of it is not here yet, at least here, but it's coming.
And you know, it doesn't seem to be affected by humans that much. This looks like solar activity is the main culprit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm not an expert in terms of climatology.
Neither am I.
I think that everyone who has studied this seriously will agree that warming is taking place. What the points of disagreement are, to what degree is it impacted by human activity? And because if you look in the climatological record, you see many periods in the past where there have been warmings and then big coolings, even almost mini ice ages, and then warms up again and so on. So this variation in temperature is there with or without humans. But the human contribution is, I think one could make, people do make a good case, that our greenhouse gases and so on, they're not helping the situation, that's for sure.
Right, but, right. I mean, for a while it was like, the cows are passing too much gas, there's too much methane.
It's probably true. I don't think you can dispute that you pump a lot of methane and various other carbon dioxide and whatever into the atmosphere. It just accelerates the process and exacerbates it. But the big question is, by how much?
Well, we could solve that very easily. Everybody just have a steak. Done
something
deal.
Like that.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I think that it is a problem. You mentioned a moment ago about these various items on my hit list, those 11 X events in the book, that they're not independent. And so people can say, pick out one item from that list and say, oh, this is very unlikely. It could happen, but the likelihood is, you know, 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100, whatever it might be. And it might even be true. And you might even be able to make the same story for each one of those 11 things. But then ask the question, what about the likelihood of something on that list happening over the next year or 5 years? Well, all of a sudden, the likelihood goes way up. In fact, I did this calculation. The likelihood, if you assume there's a 1 in 100 chance, and there's, let's say, 10 items on the list, you have the likelihood of something on that list happening is something like 1 in 5 over some fixed period of time. And then you say, but that assumes that they're all independent. And if they are dependent, then all of a sudden the likelihood, it gets higher. And if you add 20 items on the list, then all of a sudden the likelihood of something happening is like 1 in 3. And if you take my list of about 40, then all of a sudden you're up over a half. So the point here is that these X events, while taken as individual events, they're quite rare. The likelihood of something taking place is very high. So you could say X events happen every day.
Right.
They're not as rare as you might like to think, and you can't take much consolation in saying, yes, they might happen, but not today.
Well, yeah, and a large event that happens when you're in a condition of some preparedness is going to have a lot less effect than a small event comparatively, but there's no preparation for it.
Yeah,
the effect will be the same.
Get blindsided. That's the point. And the preparation is it might be a little bit painful, or it might to some people seem sort of pathologically paranoid, but I'd rather be pathologically paranoid than get wiped away by just, you know, it's like the story about the three little pigs, you know. I'd rather build my house of bricks.
Every time. Let's take a quick call. You want to, east of the Rockies? Let's talk to Anna in Philadelphia and see what's on her mind. Anna, are you there?
Yes, I am. Happy Father's Day to everybody.
Thank you very much.
I'm a big World War II buff, and I don't remember where I heard or read, but Hitler and the Germans were running low on gasoline and oil, and what they used was natural gas. And also the biplanes that performed, I don't know, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, used castor oil as fuel. Now, I don't know what that would cost to produce. But we are the, my understanding is we are the largest, we have so many reserves of natural gas, although this administration is trying to shut it down. But why can't we, if the Germans, we used it, we didn't switch to it then because the oil was so plentiful here and so cheap. But if they used it successfully back then, why is, you know, why are we in the Middle East? Why is this such a problem?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, the castor oil was for the actual motor oil, and it would, the fumes would make you sick.
Okay,
I don't think they used it as fuel. But
that. Okay,
well, that's all right. You were close. But okay. Yeah, what about that? Any move to, you see any move in the future of maybe some sort of a positive X event where we decide to get off actual gasoline and go with a, maybe it's still produced from the old, it's still hydrocarbon fuel, but it's not gasoline.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as I said at the top of the show, that every X event contains its silver lining. Let's put it that way. Just about every one in the course of time can be seen as being something positive rather than negative. And my own feeling about the oil problem is, I mean, maybe it's a little bit extreme, but I think we ought to use up this oil as fast as possible rather than try and save it, because you're never going to get into a really sustainable energy situation until you have an X event. It won't sort of gradually just sneak up on you. But I think getting back to Anna's question about why don't we use natural gas or some other alternative now, I think that that's a good question. And I think the ultimate answer comes down to money. How much does it cost you to get at that natural gas in order to get a certain amount of energy out of it? And this is the big attraction to petroleum, is that at least up to now, it's been relatively cheap to get at. It's a cheap source of energy. And now, you know, sometimes people talk about, you know, the tar sands in Alberta containing, you know, how many zillions of barrels of oil and so on. And it's true, but how much energy do you have to put in to liberate that oil? Well, a lot. So the net gain is not like just drilling a hole in the ground and having this stuff come pumping up. You have to put in a lot of energy to get maybe a little bit more energy back out. And it's not worth it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, you know, China is huge. A couple of billion people there. And it may be a while before they're all driving SUVs and so forth.
Yeah.
But it does seem like a really bad idea to continue to really foster this sort of consumption, because last time I checked, there's not a, everybody can get together on a carbon tax and get paid, but they can't seem to get together to find a true alternative source of energy, renewable sources of energy, since energy itself can't really be renewed. We will continue with Dr. John Casti, X Events, The Collapse of Everything, when we return. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll continue with our last segment with Dr. John Casti tonight. His book is X Events, The Collapse of Everything, and a few of your calls on this Father's Day morning here on Coast to Coast AM. John B. in with you for the ride tonight with Dr. John Casti. You know, we've gone through a lot of scenarios here, and there are still a lot more. We didn't cover the pandemic thing yet, but in fact, I didn't know that in 89, a secret military SWAT team or a team of soldiers and scientists were mobilized to stop the virus breaking out of the nation's capital. I missed that one.
Yeah, well, that came from Richard Preston's book that I referred to in that chapter on when Ebola fever was brewing up, and there was a laboratory outside Washington that had a bunch of it there that got loose, and the SWAT team had to come in and really stamp it out before it started a major pandemic of a very, very dangerous and deadly disease in the Washington area.
Well, Dr. Castor, you know, so there's a bunch of stuff out there that potentially can get us. So in this final segment that we have, because this has been a really, really quick 2.5, almost 3 hours, what can we do as individuals to prepare for these X events? How can we become more resilient as individuals, you know, societies, organizations?
Okay. Well, first of all, unfortunately, I don't think there's any sort of magic bullet or one-size-fits-all formula for what you can do or I can do or your company might be able to do. I think each situation you have to look at in the context of the properties and peculiarities of that situation. So, but in very, very general, broad terms, first thing you can do is remain adaptive and flexible as an individual. Don't get sort of locked into a kind of web of commitments and a lifestyle and so on that is so intimately tied up with various infrastructures that we take for granted in everyday life that all of a sudden you go into total collapse mode if one of these infrastructures ends up disappearing or is even interfered with for an uncertain period of time.
So don't get the camping means no room service mentality.
Yeah, well, it might mean, I mean, if you really took it literally, like a lot, there are a lot of survivalists in America, guys, you know, living out in the forest with guns and growing their own food and so on. I mean, I don't have anything against the idea of developing some survival skills, but if you live in an apartment in Manhattan, you're not going to be going out on your terrace and growing all your food, that's for sure.
Or hunting game.
Or even having fresh water. I mean, I remember when there was a power failure in New York City in 1977. I was a professor at NYU at the time, and I lived in a building owned by the university down in Washington Square, and I lived on the 17th floor of this building, and it was very irritating to have to schlep bottles of water, fresh water, up 17 flights of stairs just for drinking, let alone taking a shower, because, you know, the electric pumps didn't work. The elevator didn't work. And it was the worst part about it was not even necessarily the electric failure itself. It was the uncertainty of knowing when it's going to come back. That's the most enervating aspect. If I knew it was going to be out for 2 full days, I could, you know, make some preparations ahead of time to get through that period. But if you don't know if it's ever going to come back, then it really gets on your nerves real quick. But at a societal level, I think one of the things you can do is try and build in more resilience into the infrastructures that we depend upon. And by that, I mean doing a better trade-off between just pure, I'll call it economic efficiency, profit maximization, if you like, and building in some resilience, which often means some measures of redundancy, backup systems and the like, so that if you get a shock, an unpredictable shock, that you have something to fall back on. You have a bit of a buffer. Let's put it that. It's like having money in the bank, you know?
Well, you know, it really kind of sounds like the old Boy Scout motto of be prepared.
Yeah, well, it is.
You just can't lean on these systems indefinitely and not expect it at some point. I remember having a power outage one time, a huge storm. In the great American Southwest, it resulted in the electricity going off in the whole neighborhood for 4 days.
Yeah, it can happen. And it's if you have, first of all, a plan ahead of time. You see, one of the things that's bad is basically saying, I'll make a plan after it happens. I'll worry about it when it happens. Well, by then, it's too late. It's too late. You can't start making your plan after it happens. Yeah, you have to have a plan in place so that if the event takes place and you can't prevent it, that you have some steps and you have the equipment that you need to implement a reasonable survival plan.
You know, that goes back to the old aviator training. And one of the things that I tried to keep in mind at all times was, what are the next two things that I need to do at some point?
Yeah. I think that's a good way to look at it. I mean, if you try and look at the overall situation, then it might seem like it's too overwhelming. Yeah, and you just sort of throw up your hands in frustration. You hope for the best. Put your head down in the ground like an ostrich and wait for to see what takes place. But if you just take a more immediate perspective and say, as you said just a moment ago, what are the next two things that I should be doing? That's enough. That gets you. It's like writing a book. If you think about writing 300 pages, it seems overwhelming. But if you just say, well, what's the next sentence that I have to write? Then it becomes manageable.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's speak with Richard in Washington. Richard, are you there? If you are, please come upon the bridge of the mothership and speak with Dr. Casti.
Hi, John, and hi, Dr. Casti.
Hello, Richard.
I do want to expand just briefly on what John brought up about the reality of individuals being prepared, especially in relation to a long-term X event. Now, I consider myself extremely prepared food-wise, but none of my neighbors are. So can you give me an optimistic viewpoint of what I do if I'm extremely prepared and I have a bunch of people around me who are extremely despaired? That can be pretty dangerous for me.
Keep it on the down low.
Yeah.
When you're in a neighborhood, that's pretty hard to do.
I was going to ask you, do you live in the city or out in the countryside?
No, I'm in the sticks.
In the sticks.
You know your neighbors very well out here.
Yeah, well, you're in better shape than a guy who's living in an apartment in the center of town, like I do, for example.
Right, but I'm still going to be dealing with people who are suddenly without food.
Yeah, and they're going to be trying to get a hold of some of yours, that's for sure.
Do you have any advice in your book about someone like me?
Yeah, there is some advice in the book, but have a look at the book. I don't want to say it over the airwaves in a public media.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking at it, and I understand why.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I get it.
You get it, okay.
And let's see here. I got too many screens up here. Your website is xevents.com, just xevents.com, and that'll get them to it.
Yeah, I have to put in a small disclaimer. That website is just in the process of it's operational. You can go to it, but it still needs a bit more population. And this is an action item for me just over the next few days, actually.
Are there other outlets, the usual bookstores, Amazon, so forth?
Well, yeah, or you can go to the website of the publisher, HarperCollins, where you can find a lot of pages of the book to read and have a good think, at least about the book itself. Or you can go to the website from my last book, Mood Matters. The website is moodmatters1word.net. And there you'll see some of the stuff that I talked about earlier about moods of a population and how that impacts events.
All right. How about the Wild One? That's Paul in Modesto, California. Paul, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. Great show, Mr. Wells. Dr. Casti, I have a question for you. I was wondering if you might possibly be able to explain what makes up an electromagnetic pulse and if it's man-made or created by nature, theoretically. And I have one other question. Maybe you can answer this, too. I have the same question about algorithms, and I'm wondering if either one of them, you know, how they're created or whatever, if they have a relationship to one another. And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Paul.
Okay, well, let me address the problem of the electromagnetic pulse, because that's actually one of the sections of it, my book, X Events. That electromagnetic pulse, number one, is not generated anywhere in nature. It can only be generated by human deliberate activity. And it comes about, the typical way that it would come about is if somebody sets off a nuclear weapon high up in the atmosphere, that nuclear weapon, the immediate, let's say, explosion or critical mass explosion, generates a very short-term but very powerful electric field. And that electric field broadcasts down through the space, and it can affect sensitive electronic equipment. And this was actually seen back in 1952 when they did atmospheric nuclear tests in the South Pacific. These electromagnetic pulses, which were unknown at that time, actually blew out streetlights and electronic equipment and so on in Honolulu, thousands of miles away. The reason it didn't cause huge havoc at that time is that in those days, most electrical equipment was powered by vacuum tubes, not by transistors and delicate microcircuitry. In today's world, all of our equipment, from cars, TVs, cell phones, etc., have these delicate electrical equipment. It's completely unshielded, so that a single nuclear weapon in the atmosphere high up above Kansas can affect the whole country, all of the USA. And it's not just a nuclear weapon that will do this, although a nuclear blast is the best way. You can actually create an electromagnetic pulse through conventional means, using normal explosives. And I even describe, not exactly how to do it, but describe it in that chapter, for a few hundred dollars worth of equipment, and you can go up into the hills outside your city and set off a explosion which will knock out a lot of the electronics in that localized region. It won't be a whole country because it's not up high enough. But the point is that it requires a big explosion, and which creates an electric and magnetic field. It's the electric field which does the damage. And unless electrical equipment is shielded, it will blow it out, just like getting a power surge in your computers. That's why people have surge protectors, to prevent your computer from being blown out if there's lightning or something else that puts a pulse into the electrical system. The other question about algorithms, I can't go into here. Number one, it's not part of my book, X Events, in any event, and to try and give a decent answer to it would take more than the time we have available.
Take about an hour.
Well, the next time I come on, I'll answer that question.
Sounds good to me. I think we have time for one more, maybe two. Rick in Pennsylvania, way east of the Rockies. Are you there, Rick?
Good morning, Mr. Wells, and good morning, Dr. Cassidy.
Hello. Good morning.
Fine interview by both of you, and happy Father's Day to everyone concerned. My question is about oil. It's a two-part, very brief question, and I'll listen to your answer. Given the fact that we've been educated almost since first grade that oil is a fossil fuel, and by definition, as you stated, fossil fuels are generated by dying vegetation and animal organic mass. Do you think that, would you entertain the possibility that, given the fact that the majority of our oil reserves right now, at least known oil reserves, are in the Middle East, that it would be pretty difficult for oil to actually be a fossil fuel, given the sands of the Middle East and the fact that all the vegetation and animal mass would have to be concentrated in that area? And number two, the question of peak oil. Can you also entertain the possibility that peak oil is nowhere to be found short of 300 years, and that also possibly oil is actually being produced deep within the depths of the earth as we speak? Thank you both.
Okay, well, my answer to your question is, first of all, the process of the creation of oil from organic matter, dead organic matter, mostly plants and animals, it's a process that takes millions and millions and millions of years, okay? Now, if you look at the geophysics of the Earth, what's now the Middle East, it wasn't always a desert. Millions and millions of years ago, it was a lush forest. And the tectonic plates move around over this long periods of time. So what was percolating down underneath the Middle East today, millions of years ago, it was the dead matter from forests. So the for I would certainly stand behind the claim that oil is certainly a fossil fuel, and it's certainly not negated by the fact that you have a desert now in the Middle East. As far as the peak oil issue, whether the peak is now, last year, or 300 years from now, nobody knows for sure. But I think 300 years is way too long. I think that there's not, even in undiscovered deposits of oil, I don't think you're going to be able to maintain a lifestyle and oil consumption that we're accustomed to today for another 300 years, 30 years.
How long do you think we have?
Decades.
I mean, seriously, at the current...
Decades, not centuries.
30 years, maybe?
30, 40 years, something on that order, yeah. If we don't turn off the faucet, or at least turn it way down.
Well, I'm wondering, really, along with a lot of other people, what exactly the effect is on dear old Mother Earth of pulling all this oil out of there. Now, some people say, that's the natural lubricant of the Earth. It's not fossil fuel at all. It makes its own oil. Okay, but we're still pulling it out. Even if that were true, we're still pulling it out at an enormous rate. Ridiculous.
Yeah, you're right.
So I'm wondering if an X event could be caused by just sucking too much out, and then the plate starts shifting, and here come the earthquakes followed by the tsunamis.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily discount that. I can't say that I've done any serious investigation of it, but I think that there are lots of surprises still waiting for us, and my list of 40 possibilities is always ready to be extended.
All right, well, very good. Well, so... what's the temperature over there in Vienna right now? Is it
it's around low 80s.
And low 80s already?
It's 11 in the morning, so it won't be so much. Maybe it's the high 70s now. I think it will be mid 80s at the peak today.
Do people tan there?
Yeah, in fact, my girlfriend's going to go out swimming in the Danube later today. So
sounds like a nice afternoon.
Yeah, but then this is a rare day. Don't count on it if you come here. Nobody ever came to Vienna for the weather, that's for sure.
Understood.
Wherever you're located, I'm sure that it's at least as nice, if not better.
Well, I can neither confirm nor deny that, because we come from an undisclosable location, but you know how it is.
Underground.
Well, Dr. John Casti, your book, X Events, The Collapse of Everything, is very interesting, very well written, and it's a nice volume, very nice hardback volume.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for being on the program tonight.
Yeah, it's really my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we shall have to have you back again soon. It was my privilege and pleasure to have you as our first-time guest. Well, in the end, it's the people in your life that are of the most valuable. Understanding that nobody gets away with a perfect life. That's just what we work for. As for Father's Day, call your dad. See your dad if you can. If there's a hatchet that needs to be buried, bury it. If there's somebody that you need to tell you love them, do it. Especially where your dad's concerned. Well, your mom too, but this is Father's Day. You know, if things work out the right way, the day will come when your hand will go to that phone, and then you'll think, oh yeah, for a moment I forgot. Happy Father's Day. Until next Saturday night and beyond, be well.